Hi everyone, I hope you had a pleasant summer. This week marks the first of the new year of the Economic History Podcast. As my guest, I was honored to have Professor Hans-Joachim Wolff, UBS Foundation Professor of Economics at the Economics Department in the University of Zurich. A note before we begin today's episode, the first 15 minutes of our chat covers mainly academic career development. Joachim was very kind to share some insights as the editor of a top journal in economics, namely the Economic Journal, giving many tips to academics on the publication process. However, after that, we move on to cover a small share of Professor Wolff's research output. With the current tragedy of Afghanistan in mind, we look at one of his papers, his most recent, in fact, with Maurizio Drelichman and Jordi Vidal-Robert. And that was published in the National Academy of Sciences, and it's called The Long-Run Effect of Religious Persecution, Evidence from the Spanish Inquisition. We then look at his 2012 paper, Persecution Perpetuated, The Medieval Origins of Anti-Semitic Violence in Nazi Germany. That was published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics with Nico Voigtländer. When reviewing the dark side of social capital, the name of that paper is called Bowling for Fascism with Shankar Satyanath, and again, Nico Voigtländer, and that's published in the Journal of Political Economy, 2017. Finally, we look at his paper called Highway to Hitler with Nico Voigtländer, and that's forthcoming in the American Economic Journal. All of these papers and many more can be found on Professor Wolff's website, that's jwolff.com, and I would really recommend you to look there. Anyway, that's all. After a nice long summer, this was a really pleasant way to kick off the first in the new series of the Economic History Podcast. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Take care of yourselves. See you in 2 weeks. So Professor Hans-Joachim Wolff, thank you very much for joining us today. It's a real pleasure to start the new season with you after the summer break. Before we get into discussing today's topic, I want to ask you the usual question that I start off with, and that is, why is economic history important to you, and maybe how you got into the field to begin with?
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me. So I would say pure opportunism. Okay. So I wanted to actually be a historian. And despite having what some people describe as a Teflon plated ego, I wasn't quite sure I was going to cut it in academia and actually get a chair at the end of it. So I thought better buy some insurance and do a minor in economics as well. That's how I started studying in Germany. And those two things very happily lived side by side. You know, they'd occasionally mention the Great Depression and economics, but that was about it. And then, you know, by some accident more than design, I ended up as a visiting student in Oxford. And I still remember attending Charles Feinstein's undergraduate seminar. And I think he was basically just doing review for undergraduates who are about to take exams. And I sat there and I realized that all the stuff that I've been doing in economics could actually sort of inform our understanding of the past. And I was just like, man, that's what I want to do. So it wasn't a single paper. It wasn't a single book. It's a no desert island, this kind of moment. But when it sort of clicked in the back of my mind, I was like, of course, man, that's what you wanted. And then you discover all these papers and you start reading explorations. And I still remember sort of doing my laundry at St. Anthony's in the basement, sitting on the tumble dryer and reading a super cheap subscription for students of the Economic History Review. And I just sort of couldn't control my excitement, right? I mean, talk about freakish. Where everybody else was in the St. Anthony's bar, late night bar drinking. So yeah, that's sort of what happened.
Okay, so there wasn't a book or there wasn't a paper that still inspires you?
Oh, no, there's many of those. one book I absolutely love is McNeil's book on disease and epidemics, right? It tends towards the more narrative type of history, I would say. Something that I fell in love with is H.D.F. Kitto's Short History of the Greeks. So as a schoolboy, I read an awful lot of ancient history. I'd always wait for the new history school book to arrive. That's actually something that I would mark on my list of failures. I didn't get into Roman or Greek history, economic history. I'd sort of promised myself that once I get tenure, I was going to do more of that. And when I visited MIT and had a chance to spend some time with Peter Timmon, I thought this is my opportunity. But, you know, then we started doing stuff on English banks and so forth. And I developed some other interests too. So I never really got around to that.
We're kind of privileged to have you today because you're just stepping down as an editor of a major journal. Before we get into maybe some tips for people coming through now, like grad students or whatever, maybe you have a really diverse group of papers. You've covered some really cool, interesting, quirky experiments. How does one come up with topics? Like, where do your ideas actually come from?
Okay, a couple of thoughts on that. So what makes a great paper? Well, we all pretty much have a common understanding of what are important topics, right? So, and they don't change that much. So we hand them sort of like leaky buckets from one generation to the next. And sometimes it changes a little bit, but what's important or interesting, we tend to agree on, and most papers are on something important, right? Then there's sort of good technique, just getting it right, okay? And that's, of course, become much better. People are much more aware of challenges of doing good empirical work. So if you've been to a decent PhD program, you sort of pretty much know what you're doing. So those two things, they're essential, but they're commodities. Then there's a third thing, and that's the originality or novelty of the thing that you work on. And that's where 95% of the variation between papers and publication outcomes and so forth comes from. So the thing that's kind of heart-stopping and that's really hard to negotiate as a PhD student, but also for academics, is that you have to sort of commit to a few number of projects. Or as a PhD student, ideally just this one thing that you think can be really great. And then you have to try to make that as amazing as possible. And of course, that is kind of the exact opposite of what human nature is made for, right? We want to sort of have plenty of eggs in different baskets and hedge our bets. And there's also a certain need for intellectual variety and entertainment, greater for some of us than others. And none of those things really help with this, you know, you're my one and only research project and I shall never look at any other kind of thing that's essential for writing that great job market paper. And once you have a job, it doesn't really get much different, right? People basically want you to do the same thing, maybe with variations. And then, you know, if you're lucky and you sort of develop a set of papers with similar themes but different applications, then it's a little bit like marketing Coca-Cola. You know, you become a brand, you stand for a certain thing because people have this need for cognitive shortcuts. And then there's, you know, your name and then it triggers certain associations. I'm not sure how much of that I've done. I've certainly jumped around a lot. I've done stuff on Spain in the 16th century and sovereign debt and, you know, cultural persistence and English banks and interwar Germany and stuff like that. So people are often sort of saying, what's the common theme? And I tell them the common theme is that I get easily bored. So I just like to get into something new and see how, where it takes me. And that's a terrible way to manage your career, right? So if you're think of this as the same thing as going into investment banking or something, then you definitely should not do that. Some people that I think of as my intellectual heroes, people like Peter Timmon, they've just decided that they're just going to reinvent themselves from time to time. It means that they have fewer publications and maybe less recognition, but at some point you sort of have to figure out whether you're a shark and you have to sort of keep moving forward in order to live. Or, you know, you're a seal and you can happily sort of stay in one place, lying on your back, watching the waves go by. That's how I sort of try to explain it.
Looking through some CVs you would see online of the more senior academics, it's quite a depressing venture, really, for those of us who are still kind of climbing the ladder. It looks to a lot of people that it's all success and glory because you see so many publications from top journals and you think, how on earth am I going to get there? You get a rejection letter that puts you on the floor. I was just wondering, maybe you could talk about some of your failures or maybe just failures of senior academics that we don't often hear about. What are the common things that we should maybe take note of?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I often try to sort of, with PhD students or when I talk to junior colleagues, try to make a point of exactly that, right? That there's a sort of, I don't think it's intentional, but the way we sort of show what we do and who we are has this inbuilt bias towards airbrushed CVs. And as you mentioned, I just stepped down as an editor of the Economic Journal. The everyday job of an editor is to reject 95% of the papers, right? And only those 5% end up on people's CVs. Rejection is an everyday fact, and it happens to everyone, only to a varying extent. And the psychological impact of this, of course, for everyone is devastating. You know, I mean, the papers you love, you put years of work into them, and then, you know, the journal says no, and sometimes they don't say no in a very nice way. So all of that can be depressing. And there's a tricky thing here in the sense that, you know, when referees tell you that it isn't good enough or they're not convinced, you want to take them seriously. They're experts, and many of them, not all, sadly, but most of them, gladly and willingly and generously give off their time that they could be spending with a kid on a Saturday morning and instead basically advise you on what this paper needs to be better. And one of the reactions I've seen, which is very understandable, but also very destructive, is for people to just say, what the hell? These people know nothing. It's all nasty. I just put it in an envelope and send it out again. And typically what happens is that you get that same referee again. Because for every paper, there's just only a handful of people who are really sort of known experts in that area. And, you know, that it invites strategic behavior too. There are some people out there who try to block papers in their own intellectual backyard and so forth. So it invites some nastiness, but I would say 90% of the academic interactions are really inspired in a fairly selfless, objective way. Where people just try to sort of make things better. And even if you suspect that there's somebody trying to block your paper and so forth, my advice is always never try to guess who this person is. I've had cases where, you know, people got it so wrong trying to guess. And it's destructive. You can't know anyway, right? So just treat it as if it's just Joe Doe. And ask yourself after you've sort of calmed down and had a beer the next day, what can I take on board from these things that will make my paper stronger? There's a complementary and equally destructive tendency on the other side of the hill to do sort of the Beatles, I want to be a paperback writer kind of thing, where people throw out the baby with the bathwater, change everything, you know, just to sort of please the referee, and then the paper becomes this Frankenstein thing, right? And that's very understandable if it's a top journal and they've invited a revision, but sometimes you sort of see that even if it's a reject, and then the next iteration, you know, you're the referee again, there was some weird guy or girl in round one, they gave them a lot of bizarre advice, they've taken the paper apart. Now something that was a sort of good-looking, balanced, symmetrical thing, now is this homunculus of a paper. So that all of these judgment calls are just very tricky, right? And with uncertainty comes frustration, comes mistakes, and so forth. So I would just, you know, whenever these things stress you out, my recommendation would be go and talk to someone, especially senior people who have seen it all. You'll be surprised how open and receptive they are, because they've all been there. And just in terms of sort of figuring out what I do with this, is it actually worth trying at good journals with this? Should I just sort of send it into a lower tier journal? Is this a comment I should address? But also just sort of, you know, how do you deal with this? Right, my CV is empty. I'm 5 years out. I'm coming up for tenure. What do I do next? All these people have been there, they sympathize, they're trying to help. And I can't guarantee that it will make you feel as good as getting an accept from a top journal, but it will help you sort of navigate the emotional vagaries of the job. I would urge you to figure out who you're sending it to. So people often have too institutionalized a view. You send it to a journal. No, you send it to an editor. There's one person who will end up handling it in almost all journals. And it's much easier for that person to give your paper a fair chance if they are in the same intellectual neighborhood. Okay. If you send your paper to a journal where there isn't a single editor that has ever written a paper in this space, it's very hard for them to just do this right. And more journals now actually give you the option of actually selecting or suggesting someone that you think should handle the paper. And they don't always honor it, but they very often do. And that's like the first thing I would urge you. And if there isn't amongst the editors someone who's sufficiently close, at least make sure that amongst the associate editors, there's someone who would be you know, a good person to discuss your paper at a conference, or could have served in your committee or something like that. Because without that kind of expertise, you've just wasted 4 or 5 months. I mean, it might be a desk reject, or it might be a sort of very weird process, but like all forms of scholarship, economics and economic history become so specialized that it's very hard for people outside that area of specialization to make good judgment calls. Here's another piece of advice. I mean, one day, hopefully not too distant future, we will have conferences again and so forth. There's nothing wrong with you going up to editors and pitching your papers. Okay, so many people are hesitant to do this. They think that somehow imposing on people or not due process and so forth. And this is exactly wrong. People expect this. It's normal. And people who have been to very selective universities are brought up and trained to do this. And of course, you don't go in there and say, I have this paper, can I send it to the EJ? Let me tell you what it is. But you say, hey, you know, I have this paper, can I tell you about it? Let me just give you the pitch. And then for 3 minutes, you talk about why you think it's an amazing idea, why this literature needs it, how it connects with big questions in this space. And hopefully, you know, the editor will bite and say, oh, send me a copy. Because they are looking for exciting, amazing stuff. By doing this pitch, you're just making their job easier. They may just be able to get their teeth into something that's actually exciting and grab it for their journal, right? Even if they don't bite, practicing this kind of pitch is super important, and partly because it helps you understand what's important about your paper and how it connects, right? So this thing that I mentioned earlier, branding, Coke campaigns, etc. We're in a world where people write too many papers. I think most senior academics would agree with that, at least, which means that the amount of attention for each individual paper is quite small. And unfortunately, it puts a huge premium on soundbite style summaries. But it is what it is. So the more you can hone that skill to sort of get to what's really important about your paper in 30 seconds flat, the better you're going
to
do.
Thank you for taking the time to answer the questions about career progression in academia. But now what we'll do is we'll turn to some of your own work, your own experiments in extremism, we can say, to some extent, one part of your work. As we will be discussing long-term effects today, could you explain the idea before we begin of persistence in economics?
Persistence is one of those few things, I would say, that isn't obvious, but that we're fairly certain is actually sort of a real thing. And it's relatively recent, at least in economics, that people accept it as a fact. In the last 10, 15 years or so, I think, we sort of realized that this may actually be true. And I've dabbled a little bit in this space, wrote a paper about the long-term persistence of antisemitism, but other people have done papers on the persistence of gender roles, for example, as a function of plow suitability of different areas and so forth. And when I sort of started to give seminar talks, I remember distinctly that the reactions on both sides of the Atlantic would be very different. So the Americans would all look at you and say, this is nuts. How can this be true? You know, I mean, after 50 years, why in the same place would anything be the same? In Europe, you'd get the exact opposite reaction. People would just look at you and say, but that's obvious. I mean, you know, I still remember giving a talk in Paris and somebody put up their hands and said, I mean, in my village, we're for the revolution and we all vote socialist. And the guys in the next village over, you know, they were for the king and they're all sort of voting for Le Pen. So, of course, everything stays the same. Right. So at some point, we've just said, well, maybe it's an empirical question. Right. I think the idea that something in the past still influences things today, that level of generality is obvious and not terribly exciting. We have to think long and hard about what those things are and what their continuation means. And perhaps even more excitingly, I think the thing that's really exciting about persistence is where it doesn't happen, right? Now that we sort of established that many things stay the same, how do we think about stuff that's new, right? There's sometimes radical change, which, you know, is more of a surprise than we gave it credit for. But if you just think back to, say, Mad Men, right, this American television series about advertising executives on Madison Avenue, you know, that's the generation of my parents. And it's the planet of the apes. You know, all the women are secretaries. All the men start drinking at 11. Lunches take 3 hours. No Jews and agents. It's just everybody smokes. Right? Homosexuals don't exist. They're just these sort of perverts somewhere in the closet. Nobody's ever heard of them. So it's unbelievable. Everything that we see as normal there is sort of change, right? Smoking's gone. We have gay rights. We have equal opportunities for women, at least on paper. But in terms of outcomes, to an increasing extent and certainly completely different scale, ethnicity things, we're very conscious about that. And all of that happens in what is, in terms of the history of mankind, just the blink of an eye, right? And if you put that side by side with, for example, the stuff that I did with Nico Voigtländer on the geography of anti-Semitism in Germany being the same over a period of 600 years, you start to wonder why sometimes things stay the same and why sometimes they change.
And you've recently published a paper on religious persecution and the economic consequences in the proceedings of the National Academy of Science.
That's right. So this is work with Mauricio de Eligman, we looked at Spain. So with apologies to Monty Python, nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. But we looked at what happens when people do expect the Spanish Inquisition. So the Spanish Inquisition lasts for more than 300 years, from the late 15th century to the early 19th century. But it has a regionally differential impact. There are regions of Spain that it barely touches and other areas where it's very active. The first thing we have to make sure is that, you know, there isn't some kind of historical driver of where they go that then sort of determines everything else. So we actually try to sort of see whether they go to more religious places or places that are poorer to start with. And that's just not true. The data isn't great, but for what we can say and tell, the exact opposite is true. They go to areas that are less religious, which is sort of their mission statement, right? They're trying to find heretics and stamp out heresy. They also go to areas that are richer because the institution is self-financing, so they don't get a budget line from the king or the church. They basically live from the fines they impose, and you know who you go after. You go after the rich people because that's where the money is. So we then say, okay, we compile this measure of how present the Inquisition is in everybody's life, meaning what percentage of years between the 1480s and the 1830s is the Inquisition persecuting somebody from your community? And that turns out to be hugely correlated with things like GDP, but also education, trust. So it makes you more religious, it makes you less trusting, it also makes you less educated, it makes you poorer, or at least those are the correlations that we find. Now, you know, that's in terms of sort of long-term persistence, not super long, right? It's basically 200 years. But at the same time, it's in the context of a country that's undergone tremendous change, even in the last 50 years, right? With the majority of the population moving from the countryside to the cities, much higher levels of education, much higher levels of income. So the fact that even in the context of these very strong shocks, you still see the sort of differentiation and these regional echoes of persecution, we thought was interesting.
And it's very relevant considering the tragedy of Afghanistan right now. I think people would be surprised to realize that you have data. You have almost 7,000 data points in that paper. What was the kind of data you were looking at?
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting too. So the Inquisition, as you can guess, wasn't the most popular institution in Spanish history. So once it gets abolished, basically the local population celebrates by turning the archives and the seat of the Inquisition into cinders, and a lot of stuff gets burned down. So there's a handful of tribunals where the records survive, Toledo and so forth, where the records are good, and historians have looked at those, and they're amazing, and they give you a lot of texture. Now, if you want to do something broader and more systematic, those are not great, right? You have survivorship bias and so on. Now, what we did was to actually look at a type of document that's not as rich, but it's available basically for the entire period and with very few losses of documents. And that's called the relaciones de causa. So these are annual abstracts of the cases that a tribunal persecutes. And it's basically like a set of abstracts that they send to Madrid, to the central office, and just say, this is how we've kept busy. Okay. So these we have, and we know where the accused comes from. We know where they were born, where they live, and where the trial takes place. And we use all this geographical information. That's how we get to 7,000 observations, right? So this is the number of communities in Spain for which we have data. And it's very, very finely grained data. Now, truth be told, like in many of these studies, you know, there's an awful lot of zeros in any one year. So you need to, there's an econometric challenge, there's also a conceptual challenge, how to think about it. You need to think about things like population density, bigger towns, they're going to do more stuff, right? So we play with all of these things, but this is basically a result that's very hard to sort of undermine. It seems very strong now. You know, there's a lot of north-south gradient and everything Spanish. So the further south you go, the poorer things become, the lower the education is. So we take care of a lot of that. It's not just the sort of time to Reconquista or something like that that's driving things here. But
so basically, the more persecution, it persists through time to realize lower levels of real GDP, lower levels of education, and lower levels of trust at a regional level.
That's right. Religious persecution is bad for your wealth and it's bad for your education. That's what this seems to say. We did a little exercise that I also did in my paper on anti-Semitism to just see how levels of demographic change interact with this. And the more a region becomes transformed because there's a lot of population growth, which typically means lots of people from elsewhere moving in, the lower that level of persistence is.
We'll move on to another paper in another experiment you looked at, this time using Germany as a case. You look at the persistence of so-called cultural traits. Can you explain to the listeners what question you were trying to answer in the context of the broad literature here?
Yeah, so let me explain why. One of the reasons for looking at anti-Semitism is that anti-Semitism is very different from, say, the kind of stuff that people have looked at in Italy, right? There's this wonderful paper by Giso Sapienza Zingales on the independent self-governing cities of Italy, where that in the Middle Ages basically kicked out the feudal overlords. And everything today in these places is better, right? They're richer, they're more educated, people cheat less. It's, you know, just much better than cities that were run, say, by the kings of Spain in southern Italy. Now, the problem or the challenge with these outcomes sometimes is that they go with a whole package of other variables that are also influenced. So, you know, if I'm self-governing, I'm learn how to interact with others as equals. This has economic consequences. Those economic consequences might feed back into cultural attitudes. So you get these self-reinforcing cycles. And then the outcome may sort of continue to be different. And in the cross section, you find a particular pattern, but it's not really clear what this tells you. And I think a sort of self-reinforcing mechanism is very different from a pure cultural trait that's just passed on from one generation to the next. So take something completely silly, like, you know, I like chocolate and, you know, I teach my children to like chocolate. And then, you know, there's sort of generations of chocolate loving voths out there. And that's not functional, right? And it doesn't, unless it makes you particularly obese or something. There's no reason why this should be selected on, right? Whereas the other thing has a strongly it's a strong selection mechanism built into it because it sort of correlates with economic and other forms of success. Now, the good thing or the interesting thing about this paper that I wrote with Nico Voigtländer on anti-Semitism is that, well, first of all, it goes back a long time. We measure some extreme outcomes in this case, Jewish persecution, pogroms at the time of the Black Death, and then show that those towns and cities that persecuted Jews in 1350 in Germany in the 1930s, but already in the 1920s, are more anti-Semitic. They deport more Jews, they write more letters to anti-Semitic journals, they vote more for the Nazi party. Everything nasty is just hugely more frequent. And this is striking, and it's closer to the sort of pure cultural trait thing, because there's so few Jews in Germany after the 16th century. So this rich fabric of Jewish life in the Middle Ages basically disappears after a wave of pogroms in the 15th, 16th century. And then there's always some Jews around, but their number is extremely limited and regulated. And most parts of Germany, there's just no Jews at all. So for hundreds of years, apparently, people passed on attitudes towards people they never meet, never see. And then once Jews come back in the 19th century, we did some stuff that didn't end up in the paper, but you look at sort of other forms of early persecution, like the Hep riots, once the Jews become liberated after the French occupation, that already shows a similar geographical pattern. You start to look at the voting in the late imperial period for anti-Semitic single platform parties. That has the same geographical pattern built in. And then in the interwar period, it sort of really goes through the roof.
So the persistence, again, is in cultural attitudes of an invisible enemy for the most part. That happens to come back in the 19th century, but those attitudes have persisted and they're able to predict quite reliably voting for the Nazi party and all of the other things later on.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's always a question of how much, right? So do you explain all the variation in Nazi voting? No. But things like pogroms before the Nazis are in power, right? Pogroms that are just done as an expression of local sentiment in the 1920s, the ratio of those number of places that do it in the 20s is low, but the ratio between places with and without medieval pogroms is about 8-1. So the probability of you attacking Jews or doing anti-Jewish acts where somebody at least gets hurt, that's the definition, is about 8 times higher in places that have a history of persecution.
Sticking on the same region, I remember when we studied political economy, we were made to read Robert D. Putnam's book on social capital, and we heard about all of the benefits of what's called social capital. You've done a really interesting piece of research on the, quote, dark side of social capital. Before we jump into that, can we explain what social capital is?
Yeah, so the original social capital concept, Putnam put the label on it, but it goes back a long way. Alexis de Tocqueville, this Frenchman who traveled America in the 19th century, already wrote about it. It describes this rich fabric of social organizations, clubs, societies, where citizens learn to interact as equals and self-organize. And Tocqueville thought that this was incredibly important for America and helped to sort of lay the foundations for democracy. He also already mentioned that there's some dark sides. Putnam mostly brushes these away. And basically, you know, the classic bowling alone, everything that's bad in America, as he saw it when he wrote the book, had to do with this decline of social capital, meaning that, you know, the metaphorical bowling league where everybody gets together and independent of social class and so forth, just throws a few balls and has a beer. But that wasn't as frequent in the 1990s as in the 1950s. We weren't the first, so this is again with Nico Voigtländer and with Shankar Satyanath, we weren't the first to sort of put a question mark behind, is social capital always such a good thing? Social capital is a tool. It's like a hammer, and you can use it on a nail and you can use it on a child's head. So, you know, people have already said, if it solves collective action problem, maybe social capital is what makes the mafia work as well, right? So, but I think overwhelmingly this hadn't been taken very seriously in the social science discourse. The idea really goes back to Shankar and to some political scientists that he knew. They pointed out that Germany looks like the kind of place that, especially interwar Germany, that has an awful lot of social capital. So if you go to any town in Germany, you would have found an unbelievable number of clubs and associations. And, you know, there's the budgie breeders, there's the chess players, the cyclists, the people that sort of do lawn tennis, and the German Shepherd Society, everything as a club or an association, and often they sort of meet weekly, and often they just sort of get together in the local pub and have a beer. And it all looks incredibly sort of cozy and cuddly until you look at it a little bit more closely. And there was already some historical work by a wonderful historian called Koscher, who just looked at one town, Marburg. And he found that amongst those people in the associations, there was an awful lot of people who became Nazi members. And we thought, maybe we can do something systematic about that. So we collected all these address books. Germany has address books, like many other countries in the interwar period, and they list the different clubs and associations. Every club and association has to register with the local law court, and then they're listed, and they give you a name and the purpose of the club. And so and we just started counting. And we realized that those places that had an unusually high density of clubs and associations were the ones where Nazi membership spread particularly fast. Now you can say, wait a minute, what does budgie breeding have to do with joining a party led by a foaming at the mouth lunatic? And there's this, I think it's probably one of the coolest forms of social science research ever done. There's this sociologist by the name of Abel, Theodor Abel, who emigrated wisely to the United States in, I think, 1933. And in 1934, he's at Columbia. And he actually sort of signs up the Nazi party to help him with this. And he puts an ad in a Nazi newspaper and says, prize competition. You can win 500 Reichsmarks, small fortune, for the best essay on the question, how I became a Nazi. So we have like 800 of these essays and letters where people write in and describe what got them into the Nazi party. And one of them is very telling on exactly this question. It's by a young man, essentially says, you know, I always thought of the Nazis as a bunch of crooks. But then I met in the workplace this guy, and he was very pleasant and calm. And then I realized that he was one of the local leaders of the Nazi party. And this changed my perception of them completely. So what this means, of course, is that just like many other things, our attitudes and beliefs about things are affected by who we talk to. And if you have a dense network of social contacts, then it's much easier, including for an extremist party, to convince people, right? Because then the ideology has a face, and you may like that face. You may be swayed by that person and how they say things and so forth. The more contacts you have, the more likely it is that one of the different draws of people that you come into contact with is actually above the line that would persuade you. So that's what we show. I think the nice thing about it is people have thought about voting a lot. Voting is very important, right? The party wouldn't end up in office without voting. But how do they actually get the big breakthrough in terms of voting? By building the party infrastructure and organization first. So, you know, the Nazi party already has a very rich network of local groups, party organizations, and many, many members doing door-to-door canvassing and so forth long before they have the first breakthrough in the polls. And that's the other thing that we show, that as this sort of membership gets built in these towns and cities with a lot of social capital, the electoral success follows. Putnam already distinguished between what he calls bonding and bridging capital. Bridging capital brings together people of different backgrounds. Bonding capital is just the local gentleman's club and the lacrosse players, everybody from the same social background. So we're worried a little bit about this, that we're actually picking up, you know, an average treatment effect, and it's actually very heterogeneous, depends on which flavor of social capital we have. And of course, you know, in actual life, classifying this is a little bit hard, but we did what we could, looking at things that are probably more exclusive or more bonding, say veterans associations, right? So we know that the Nazis are very strong in these, that they really seize on veterans sort of lobbying for a rematch with France. But even if you just go to the budgie breeders and the chess players, it still works. It doesn't have exactly the same effect. It's slightly weaker, but it still does the job.
You also looked at voting behavior and the building of roads, which I think everybody is familiar with, again, during the 1930s in Germany. Would you like to just briefly talk about what that paper found in terms of voting behavior?
Yeah, so let me first give you the elevator pitch. So everybody thinks that pork barrel spending is a fact, right? That politicians use spending, especially on visible infrastructure projects, to get support. No journalist will ever put a question mark behind this. And then you look at the academic evidence, and it's remarkably thin. And why is that? Well, the problem is, typically, imagine that you're the president and you have to decide where to build a bridge. And there's two areas where you can build it. There's the district of Jack and there's the district of Joe. And in Jack's district, you have an 80% level of support. And in Joe's district, it's 50. Well, you're going to put it in Joe's district because he's at 50, right? He needs the support. Now, you know, at that point, if it's like that, it's not that hard to filter out how to do things because, you know, you observe the level of support, et cetera. But what of course happens in real life is that there are two candidates, you know, they were at 60 last time, but you have some indication that this time the second candidate might be at 50. And then you build the bridge and they're both at 60 again. So if you now run a cross-sectional regression, you're going to find nothing, right? Because they both end up at 60 again, but in one case it took you the bridge. So even if you have a lot of effect of this infrastructure thing, you're not going to find it. And people have tried to think of IVs to get around this. And there's some interesting papers, but I don't think as a profession we've ever really nailed this. that's why I was excited about this project, because this is like the highest profile project for the Nazis. This is where creating employment becomes most visible. So they start building very, very quickly after they come to power. This highway network, so especially in Germany, where nowadays it takes, you know, 2 decades to build a tunnel. And this is deliberate, right? They sort of show the ruthless energy, get it done attitude of the Nazi regime, and want to contrast this favorably with the gridlock and the squabbling and the talking shop politics of the Democratic Republic. So within 6 months, the shovels are in the ground, and then it takes them a little bit longer for the first segment to be opened. But the idea of the paper is just to say, let's solve this identification problem with geography. Where would you build a road? And the obvious answer is where it's cheapest. So you have these low cost, least cost paths. And we have some 1920s plans that weren't done by the Nazis. So you can just use all of that to say, let's find the segment here that if you ever wanted to build something, you really have to build here, and just see what that does. And the second innovation in the paper wasn't easy to sell, but I sort of believe it, is that we actually look at non-democratic elections, right? So the Nazis, of course, don't really want to give people a fair chance to express their preferences. So they, but at the same time, it's an interesting fact, relevant to the present too. They stage elections. They want to show how popular they are, especially the big plebiscite in 1934, when they ask people to sort of support the notion that Hitler becomes not just chancellor, but president, creating the position, if you will, of the Führer. You can only vote yes, or basically despoil the paper. But interestingly, there are some places, like my birthplace, Lübeck, where a third of the population doesn't say yes. So these guys are not on board. You know, it's not a free election. It's not fair, but it's mostly secret. You're encouraged to vote in public, but if you want to, you can vote in secret. So we think this is a strict lower bound on the level of opposition. Of course, you can't be sure that the level of local pressure is always the same everywhere. But there's some opposition and we can measure it, because there are other places where you get 100% support. Now, even if not every one of those places with 100% support is genuine, there's a gradient. And the only thing we have to worry about is that those areas where they build the highway, there's more sort of pressure or manipulation. And we do a lot of manipulation checks, but we've kind of confident that that's not what's going on. And we find pretty big effects. So this really changes the electoral preferences. Many fewer voters vote against the Nazi regime and the plebiscite proposition, the closer they are to the highway. And we think that because the employment effects are tiny, they basically bring in workers from the towns and cities. The roads themselves aren't usable. The economic benefits of having somebody else put shovels in the ground for the locals are very small. We think of this as actually sort of sending the Nazi message of, you know, we're the guys who are getting this country moving again.
Yeah.
Right. And they create this persistent myth. So if you ask people of my grandparents' generation, of course, they'd say, yeah, yeah, the Nazis were all bad. But the typical thing that you grew up, people of my generation in Germany grew up with, is that your grandparents would tell you it wasn't all bad. They built the highways, right? So this was like the one thing that redeemed a genocidal regime in the eyes of the public, that at least they got this job done. And of course, they used plans that were around long before they came to power and so forth. So we think of this as a sort of highly disaggregated exercise in just figuring out how effective propaganda combined with some seeming confirmation is in creating this narrative of success, of economic policy success for the nascent Nazi regime, and that it then helps them to be much more firmly in the saddle than they actually were in 1934.
Joachim, thank you so much for taking the time to have this fascinating discussion. I could listen to you for hours more. Really, I'm honored that you took the time to kick off this season of the Economic History Podcast.
My pleasure.